Hello and welcome. We're going to wrap up our corporate governance lectures with kind of a review of what corporate governance is. We've been talking about corporate governance for several weeks now. It starts with the elements of corporation, which is shareholders, directors, officers, and employees. Corporate governance merely is how is the corporation run. And it starts, of course, with shareholders. Remember that chart that we showed you? Because the shareholders elect the directors. The directors are the policymaking entity, and it is a Republican representative form of government whereby the shareholders vote for the directors and then the directors make policy decisions. And then they hire the officers and the employees, generally employees hired by the officers through a delegation of the directors to be able to run the corporation. So let's jump into this and where we are. Again, this is kind of just a review of everything we've been talking about. Corporate governance, running the corporation. The board of directors of the New York Business Corporation law, as well as the articles of incorporation of the corporation and the bylaws of the corporation, provide very broad powers to the board of directors to manage and run the corporation, because they are the ultimate policymaking entity of the board. The policymaking entity of the corporation, they hire the corporate officers who provide the day-to-day management of the corporation. So it all begins with the shareholders who elect the board of directors. Then the board of directors hire the officers to do the day-to-day operations of the board. The board of directors operates by meetings. Remember, they elect a chair. The chair prepares the agenda for the meeting, working with the corporate secretary to prepare an agenda. The corporate secretary sends out notices of the meeting that they're going to meet. Here's the agenda. These are the items that will be discussed. And the board of directors then turns around and takes votes and passes resolutions of the board to be able to govern it. And the meeting is the quintessential mechanism by which policy is made, including hiring the officers, because that is a board resolution on who they will do, and it's done by the meeting format, again, chaired by the chairman of the board, who's elected by the board members. The size of the board of directors has become a very high topic of corporate governance across the country. How big should your board be? Now, the bigger the corporation, you would think the bigger the board. Why? Because they have to have a diverse number of opinions. You want to have people who have expertise in different areas to sit on the board, to offer different opinions. You know, it's kind of like Congress. You want to have a very broad scope of opinions. You break down into committees. Somebody is an expert in this kind of thing or that kind of thing. You want to be able to have them on the board so they can sit in the committee and so they have that firsthand expertise. Well, the more you have diverse opinions, the more people you're going to have to provide their expertise. But the problem is the board meetings then become unwieldy. You can't have a board meeting of, you know, 2,000 people. It just doesn't work. So you have to kind of balance that, have enough experience, enough diversity on the board to be able to offer these different types of opinions that are necessary to be successful with the corporation. But you also have to have it small enough to be manageable, whereby when you hold a board meeting, everybody can come. When you have meetings, people get to listen to the different opinions because, you know, it's not taken up. The whole meeting isn't taken up by 1,800 people talking. You know, you have to be able to balance that. Big corporations tend to have boards which are 25, 30, 50 people. But that's a big board, and it becomes unwieldy at that point. So corporate governance specialists, and yes, those people do exist, have studied this issue. How big a board should you have? The primary corporate governance specialist, a person who is probably more respected than anybody else in this field, is a guy by the name of Ira Milstein. And Ira has looked at this issue substantially, written and opined rather substantively on the size of corporate boards. Ira believes that the magic number for board size is 7 people. He says when you get above 7, it becomes unwieldy. People can't focus on what others are saying because there's too many there. We ought to have boards of 7 people. Well, far be it from me to disagree with Ira, who is a brilliant man. But the problem with that is with modern corporate regulation that has come into place, such as Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, where they're putting more and more requirements on boards to break into expert committees, 7 people just can't do the workload. So you have to have a bigger board just to accommodate all these different committees and assignments. And being a board member tends to be a part-time job, not a full-time job for most people. So as a result of this, that 7 number, it's not that it's wrong, because I think Mr. Milstein's comments have a lot of merit, because when you get above that number, it makes it hard and unwieldy to be able to operate. But the problem is because of all this governmental regulation that has come in since the early 2000s on corporate boards to try and address things like the WorldCom scandal, and then after the bubble bursting with respect to mortgage foreclosures and things like that. After that period of time with Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley, just having 7 people on a major corporate board becomes a situation where there's not enough people to do the work. So again, it's not that Mr. Milstein's wrong, it's just that other factors have come into play. And as a result, 7 may not be the perfect number anymore, but he sticks to it. And I don't know that he's wrong in his principles. Problem is that there's other factors that have piled onto that. So what's the typical size of a major corporate board? Tends to be around 30. And it depends, again, on the corporation. Remember, they have to pay all these people because few people want to take on the liability and the work of being on a corporate board without being paid. And they get paid rather handsomely for, you know, the amount of time that they're working on. So, you know, that's a factor too. How much is the corporation going to pay their board members? And what's the cost of doing that? The more people you have on it, the higher your cost. So just recognize that issue. There is no perfect number. I wish there was. I think Mr. Milstein's number of 7 would be perfect outside of all these other requirements that you have. So they try and balance it on that. They want to have enough people to provide those diverse opinions without having a breakdown of unwieldiness, being able to listen to the people who are on the board when they want to talk. Okay. Officers. Officers, as we discussed in our previous lecture, are what make the corporation go. They're what make it work. The chief executive officer is where the buck stops. That's the person who will make that corporation successful or not, because they tend to be innovative. They work very closely with the board of directors. They bring back, they are a source of information for the board, and they're the implementer for the board. They do it all. And the other officers work with the chief executive officer to make sure that the policy and the vision of the corporation gets accomplished. Board policies are enforced by the corporate officers. That's how they're put into play. The corporate officers are the enforcement entity. And when I say enforcement, they are the one who carry out the will of the board and the purposes and the work of the corporation. They execute the board action. They carry out the board resolutions. They're the ones who make the corporation work. It's all about the officers. They also manage the employees. The board of directors manages the officers. They oversee them. They're the ones who decide whether or not they're doing a good job, whether they need to be retained, whether they should have a raise. Excuse me. The board of directors oversees the officers. The officers oversee all the rest of the employees. That's something that gets delegated down the line. Employee management, employee administration is done by the officers. Now, do they take certain employees and say, you're going to manage other employees? Yes, they do. Because there is frequently, when you get a big corporation, there's an awful lot of work to be done and a lot of employees. You know, certain corporations literally have hundreds of thousands of employees. So they have to manage them. And, you know, the limited number of officers of the corporation can't manage all of those people. But what they do is they manage the managers and they direct what has to be done. Now, we've been talking about corporate governance for weeks now. Remember, it starts with the shareholders electing the directors. The directors make the policies, the officers implement. The employees carry out the implementation at the direction of the officers. But what happens when this process breaks down? What happens when the corporation isn't carrying out its purposes? When the officers aren't being faithful to their fiduciary duty? When the directors aren't making policies for which the corporation was formed? What remedy does the shareholders have? Now, just like in our constitutional governments, they have the remedy to vote the directors out of office and they can fire them. That is part of the remedies that they have. But what happens if you own a small portion, significant to you, but a small portion of the shares? You can't throw them out of office because you don't have enough votes. It's one vote per share, generally. So what do you do as a shareholder when you see a breach of fiduciary duty and nobody is taking care of it? If it's an officer, the directors aren't taking care of it. If it's a director, the rest of your shareholders aren't voting the people out of office. So do you have a remedy? Yes, you do. You can sue. It's called a shareholder derivative action. And the reason why it's derivative is because you are suing on behalf of the corporation. You don't directly get any of the proceeds because generally what happens is they have to pay money to the corporation for their misbehavior, whether it be an officer or a director. If they're breaching their fiduciary duty, you can sue them and say, I think you breached your duty. You've hurt the corporation. I want you to pay it money for the damage you've caused. Now realize that shareholder doesn't get the money directly. Why? They're not suing as a shareholder. They're suing on behalf of the corporation. It's a legal fiction. The corporation can't sue for itself. It has to sue through an entity. And the directors aren't suing. Why? Because the directors have either breached their duty of oversight or they breached their duty of loyalty or care. So, what happens? The shareholders sue and they say, you director didn't provide sufficient oversight to the officer, or you officer breached your fiduciary duty with respect to your employees. And you, by doing that, you double dealt, you didn't weren't loyal, you took bad actions, something that wasn't covered under the business judgment rule. You should be paying the corporation money for your misbehavior. We lost money. Values of our shares went down. We're not as productive as we should be. That's known as a shareholder derivative action because the corporation got hurt by your breach of fiduciary duty. You can bring that against a director. You can bring it against an officer. Now, what do you do in that action? As a director, as an officer, you can raise the defense, if it's valid, of the business judgment rule. Yes, the corporation got hurt, but I was trying to make it money, and sometimes things don't work out. As the shareholder who brings the action, you have to prove that there was a breach of a fiduciary duty, duty of care, the duty of loyalty, which you owe to the corporation, director, or officer, was breached. If you cannot show that, you don't recover. If you do show that and overcome the business judgment rule, then the corporation itself gets a recovery. Now, you as a shareholder don't get direct benefit, but you get an indirect benefit. Why? Because when you get that recovery, the overall value of your share goes up, and the value of what you own is increased. That's what a shareholder derivative suit is all about. You can bring it for breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, self-dealing, conflict of interest, waste of corporate assets, accounting wrongdoing, inflated false or misleading financial statements, inflated executive compensation, management or board decisions that expose the company to harm or violate consumer protection or other laws. Those are the basis for shareholder derivative suits. But they all come down to two things: a breach of fiduciary duty knowingly made by the officer or the director. So if you breach the fiduciary duty, either the duty of care or the duty of loyalty to the corporation, they can be held responsible. If they don't, and again, most of this is covered by insurance policy unless they did it intentionally. Most of this is saying you did it negligently, but if you can demonstrate intentionally, the insurance will cover it. But if it is negligent, the insurance will. The corporation gets a substantial payment and probably ramifications from that, because if you win a shareholder derivative suit against, say, an officer, the board of directors will end up dismissing them. And if you win it against a director, the shareholders will review that when they're casting their votes for election. Again, we're back to our chart. This is the final wrap up on our chart. This chart tells you everything you need to know about it. Corporate governance. It's a good review. I recommend it.
Hello and welcome. We're back to talk about corporate personnel. And it's very important when you're talking about boards of directors to kind of remember the issues of corporate personhood. You know, we've talked about what the board of directors does, what their members' overall obligations are. We talked about the board powers, and we talked about the chairman and the board members and the committees. And now we're going to talk about corporate personhood. And the reason why corporate personhood is so important, and remember, we kicked off corporations with our famous case involving Dartmouth College, where the United States Supreme Court, all the way back in the time almost to the nation's founding, back in the early 1800s, said that a corporation is an artificial person under the law. And remember, going all the way back to Roman times, it was viewed as an artificial person under the law. Well, the critical aspect of that is because in order to have the continuity of a corporation where it can have perpetual lifetime, where it can operate with limited liability, you need this corporate personhood. And you have, as a result, certain rights of a corporation because it is that artificial person. Let's get into it, because it's important to know it when you're talking about board members, because remember, the primary fiduciary duty is to that corporate person. And if you didn't have that corporate personhood, you wouldn't have that fiduciary duty, and you wouldn't have the success of a corporation. Remember, as we said, the whole element of a corporate personhood is that it is an artificial person under the law. It's declared in the famous case of Dartmouth College versus Woodward. It's the legal legal principle that a corporation is that artificial person under the law with many of the same rights and privileges of a natural person. Corporations have their own separate legal status. It is separate from their associated human beings, the shareholders, the directors, the officers, the employees. They're separate from the corporate person. And they have their own, the corporation has its own constitutionally protected rights as a result of that. The rights of the corporation as separate legal persons, they have the right, first and foremost, to enter into contracts with other parties. If you didn't have that right, you couldn't have limited liability. Why? Because it's separate. That's why you have that limited liability. It's separate from the shareholders. It's separate from the directors. It's separate from the officers. It's separate from its employees. And as a result of that, that's why limited liability works, because it is vested in that corporate personhood, in that person, that artificial person under the law. And as that, the law has recognized in the United States that corporations enjoy most constitutional rights that are associated with natural persons. So most of the rights that you have as a natural person, the Bill of Rights, all the rights that you would generally enjoy as a person, as a human being, also are vested in corporations because of their artificial status as a person under the law. Now, there's certain rights you don't have, and it's more important to talk about the rights you don't have as a corporation, because everything else you do, and it's pretty broad. If you tried to list all the ones they do have, you'd be here forever. What rights don't they have? Well, they're not a natural human being, so we don't grant them the right to vote in a political election. They can't vote for president of the United States. They're not citizens under the 14th Amendment, which would grant them the voting rights. That's why that is. They don't have self-incrimination rights. Why? You can't throw a corporation in jail. That's the purpose of those self-incrimination rights. They're not given the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And we discussed this previously, where a corporation can be discriminated against as an out-of-state entity. So if you're a non-domestic corporation, the state in which you are located, if you're not a domestic corporation of that state, if you're not chartered in that state, then you can be discriminated against. People cannot, because the Privileges and Immunities Clause states that all persons cannot be discriminated against. If you go if I'm a New York State resident and I go to Pennsylvania, I can't be discriminated against on that basis. But corporations, however, can. Now, they're also not afforded due process clause liberty rights that relates to the self-incrimination. You can't throw a corporation in jail, but they're given due process rights. So they're not given due process liberty rights because, again, they don't need it because you're not throwing them in jail. They're not a human being that gets incarcerated. But you do give them due process rights. They do have the same due process rights if you go to sue them or you go to prosecute them that an ordinary natural human being would have. They also don't have specific human rights that are given to us as human beings. They don't have the right to serve on a jury. Why? Because they're not there. They don't exist as a natural person. So how could they ever do a jury? Because they can't assess the evidence or any of that. They don't have the right to run for political office. Why? They're not a human being on that. They don't have the right to marry. Again, not a human being. Or to procreate. They can't. They're an artificial person. They don't have the right to travel. Why? They're not a person. So a natural person, I should specify. They have all other rights. They just don't have certain person rights of a natural person. Now, the fiduciary duties, we discussed this previously. Your fiduciary duty as a director is to the corporation itself. That is a fiduciary duty because they are an artificial person. They have the limited liability, and you owe the duty to the corporation, not just to the shareholders who are the owners of the corporation. You owe it first and foremost to the corporation itself for their well-being, for its well-being, for its financial benefit, for its prudence. You owe that duty first and foremost to the corporation as a corporate person, as an artificial person under the law. You have to understand that you have a duty to make sure that the corporation is financially sound. Why? Because your duties to that corporation and that it operates consistently with its policy goals. Because again, your duty is to that corporation. Your duty of care and duty of loyalty. Your duty of care relates to your duty to the corporation, that you're attentive, that you will perform your decision-making and oversight functions with due diligence. Why? Because you need to take care of that corporation as a separate person. You need to not have conflicts of interest. That's your duty of loyalty. And what is that about? You have to do that as if it is a separate person, because it is under the law. You have a conflict with that person if you have a conflict of interest. And that is why corporate personhood is so important. Now, as we said, it's a separate person under the law. This has been so since Roman times. It's been viewed as that artificial person under the law, as a separate, distinct entity from its shareholders, from its owners, from its managing board of directors, and from its officers. It is a separate person. And because of that, it has limited liability. That limited liability is intrinsically linked to the corporate personhood. Its rights that it has is intrinsically linked to that corporate personhood. And because of its corporate personhood, the law also designates that corporations have distinct entity powers. It can contract in its own name. It can sue or be sued. It can convey and own property. It can be held criminally liable for crimes. It is a separate person. It's a artificial person under the law. And unless the certificate of incorporation expressly limits the powers of that artificial person, it will be deemed to have any power that a lawful business can engage in. Its rights are not just limited. They're unlimited unless the law curtails them. What are the meaning of these corporate rights? The corporate personhood refers to the ability of corporations to be recognized by law as an artificial person with certain constitutionally protected rights. One of these critical rights is to act as a person would under the law. Corporate personhood is intrinsically linked to limited liability. If you didn't have corporate personhood, you wouldn't have limited liability because it would be linked over to the other people and they would be held responsible. But because of the fact that you had a separate corporate personhood under the law, you can have limited liability, which means that shareholders' risks are limited, that directors and officers do not have the liability of the corporation, and that employees do not have the liability of the corporation. The corporation has the liability of the corporation, and as such, you have limited liability, which allows the influx of enormous sources of capital, because people know that their risk is limited. They know what their exposure is. Now, that's all we have for tonight. We're now going to go on to our case, which is about the constitutional rights of a corporation. See you next week. Thanks so much.